Hey guys, this is The Conversation. It's episode 147 with Caitlin Masley, Brooklyn-based artist and a serial artist residency goer. You'll learn a lot about the whole international artist residency scene and what that's like. Its pros, its cons, its challenges, its benefits. And also the same applied to her current home in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, which is both inspiring culturally, but also environmentally challenging. So we'll talk quite a bit about that. I am Michael Shaw. The website for the podcast is theconversationpod.com, where I invite you to go see images of the charming towns in Switzerland, where Caitlin has done residencies, as well as images from her installation that is opening this very day / evening at the Katona Museum of Art up in Westchester County. If you are a New York City area resident, go check it out. And also where I request that you fill out our new survey that just went up a couple weeks ago. It is at theconversationpod.com/survey. So just plug in that suffix / survey. And it's got 9 questions. It should take you 5 minutes tops. So I really would appreciate it if you would fill that out. It will really help us know what your listening habits are. It is an anonymous survey, so it won't tell you too much about you, just the generals, which will help us know where to go. And if you only want to give a couple of minutes, I understand, just do 7, 8, and 9 of the 9 questions. That would help us a lot alone. But if you can do all of them, great. Last episode was with feminist performance artist Kristen Clifford. That was quite a whirlwind of an episode. Very thoughtful, thought-provoking, and heavy. Recommend you check out that. Also, in case you're not aware, we just re-released, thanks to our move over to the Libsyn platform, a number of episodes that were in the podcast archive. So those are now in your feed. If you want to go listen to them, some classics from about 3 years ago or so, including Jonas Wood, collector Dean Valentine, performance artist Nicole Hebron, Davida Nemiroff and Mika Marple of Night Gallery, Amanda Ross Ho, so many more that are from episode about 40 to 80, something like that, the Conversation Three-Way series, including the episode on art and therapy. So many to choose from the past. If you have not done the whole back catalog, recommend you check some of those out. And I will have more for you in the back end. In the meantime, please take a few minutes and fill out the survey at theconversationpod.com/survey. Let's get to this conversation with Caitlin, and I will talk to you more in the back end. Thank you very much. I appreciate your listening. I hope you enjoy this one. Especially in New York these days, is about where you are, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, under the BQE, right?
Almost literally, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
In which neighborhood in Brooklyn?
There should be a new name for it. Technically speaking, we're in Carroll Gardens.
Okay.
We're on the street. We're like the last street of, like, right at the crux of the Gowanus and the BQE. So, like Dumbo, I've been trying to think of an acronym, a new acronym for, like, South Carroll Gardens, which is, like, SOGA, which is not good. And it doesn't include the BQE, so, or Gowanus. So, like, SOCA Go, or, like, South Carroll Gardens Gowanus, mm-hmm. or, like, SOCA Go. I mean, you can't really pronounce BQE.
Right.
Something. So I'm a little bit at a loss. Basically, it's more like the point, like we're right next to the Smith and Ninth Street FG stop.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really funny because years ago, well, not necessarily funny, haha.
Mm-hmm.
But years ago, I was a finalist for the MTA Art in Transit project.
Wow.
For this stop. And I had never been here because I was living over in Fort Greene.
Mm-hmm.
And I came over and I was like, I know nothing about this neighborhood. This is amazing. And the Smith and 9th Street stop is so high. Like it's, and through my research, I was just like, oh, this is amazing. It's the highest subway stop in like all the transit stops for the MTA. And it was pretty fascinating. And then I didn't get it. And then like literally a year and a half later, I moved right next door.
Wow.
And so every day I have to like look at the public art that's there now. And I have this ongoing dialogue with the subway art and the Gowanus canal.
So how do you feel about your competitor who beat you out, as it were?
Oh, I mean, I know her work well, Allison Schatz. And actually, and I don't know her. I don't know that we've ever met. But I do know that we've been finalists for the same thing in a couple of instances. And she always has gotten it, and I haven't.
Wow.
That's
infuriating.
It's okay. I mean, I'm pretty honored. I like her work a lot. So,
do you think it's just strictly her work, or do you think she's got the whole bureaucracy application thing figured out?
Oh, I have no idea. If you can figure out the whole bureaucracy at the MTA Arts and Transit and other public commissions in the city, then you've got it made.
Right.
I think that's an enormous combobulation of mystery and committees and people and moving parts that is very hard to understand. Although, props to the MTA Arts and Transit for putting all their applications online finally.
Oh, okay. But let's get back to your place. What would you say the most prominent sounds that you get to experience are? Are they more the train, the subway that's not sub at that point, or is it the BQE? Or both mixed together?
Well, this building is an old, light manufacturing industry building. It's enormous. And they made it into, it, of course, it went out of the way of artist studios and then rentals and then condos. And there used to be a big part of it, they made taffy.
Wow.
Which sounds awesome. Yeah. And so people often refer to it, or I've heard it often referred to as the taffy factory. Although I think someone debunked that to me, saying actually they only had two floors or something like that. And I was like, well, thanks for ruining that.
Right.
When we first moved from Fort Greene, we were living on the 8th floor and on the outside of the building, right near where the subway meets the building. And it was great. It was close enough that you could almost see the people's expressions in passing by, which also reminded you not to walk around your apartment naked.
Wow. And you mean that great in the literal sense or in the completely facetious sense?
No, like literally.
Why? What was great about that? You get to semi-voyeur people in the subway?
Yeah, I guess. But also, I love being near trains. I've always been near trains. When I was in graduate school in Tucson in Arizona, and undergraduate in West Virginia University in Morgantown, I've always been near train, or the sound of a train. There's something really comforting in that to me.
Oh, okay.
We also have, we also have a big, like the last concrete place. I wanted to say, like, it's not a factory, but maybe it's more like where the trucks just come and pick it up and they ship it out, or they drop it off and then mix the mixers come in. I'm not exactly sure what they do, but every morning, like at 6 a.m., they would have like so and so online. Da da da. It was really loud.
Yeah,
and we didn't mind that either. But the apartment, the landlord was not fabulous, and the apartment was sort of sold from underneath of us. which was not fun. But then we got lucky and took over another lease within the building. And now we look into the courtyard, which is quite large for a building this size, and has these really tall trees. But now we hear more of the BQE and the cars, and there's an oil depot. So if we're here during the day, we do hear some of the trucks going by. And a lot of people on the street going from Smith and Ninth into Red Hook. So
you hear them
walking by.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can hear a lot of, because of the way that the sound bounces into the building.
Right.
The conversations sound as if they're like, even though that they're like, you know, way out on the sidewalk, it almost sounds like they're like right underneath the window.
Mm.
And they can be fantastic. I mean, I think if you don't love the sounds of the city and their various modes, it'd be pretty hard to live here.
Right. Okay. Got it. So you went from one charming urban sound pattern to another, basically.
Yeah, I guess. Depends on how you define charming.
Well, you seem fairly relatively charmed by it, or maybe more like tolerant is the right word.
I like it.
Yeah,
it reminds me where I am.
Okay. So really the only downside then, based on our prior conversation, is that you have this lack of quality air around you that you're...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which we could spend a whole episode talking about, but maybe we should just perhaps leave it at that unless it comes up later. I want to transition, unless you have something that you want to add to that. I wanted to talk about Gutenberg because... I think it's interesting it was interesting for me to learn about as a place and as a residency. And so you're one of the people who run it, this Gutenberg Arts, which is a residency right over the river from Manhattan, right?
Right. And the disclaimer is I've recently left.
Oh.
To return to teaching.
Oh, okay.
Let's just
figure out what it means that we're talking about this thing that you've now left. How long ago was it that you left there?
July 1st was my last day.
Okay, so you just are off their platform.
Yeah.
And how long were you with them?
2 years.
Okay.
But I came in to do a really specific set of tasks and infrastructure building.
Mm-hmm.
And we pretty much accomplished that. I didn't project to be there really more than a handful of years. I think that it was founded by a retired architect and his wife, who's a ceramicist, Dan and Sarah Bartolus, and their son, Matt Bartolus, joined them to be the director. And then they have some other part-time people who run the studio, the printmaking and the ceramics. They're from Fort Lee, which is right. Gutenberg Arts is in Gutenberg, which is a bit north of Jersey City, like 20 minutes in New Jersey. So basically, if you're standing on the Upper West Side at like West 70th Street on the water, you could look directly across and... it's right there. Basically.
And that was one of the things that I was so amazed by, is that there was this, I don't know, is Gutenberg itself because or in addition to Gutenberg Arts an arts-oriented community or not really?
You know, I think it was, but a little bit on the down low. It's so easy to get to.
Yeah.
And then... there's quite a large Latin American community there, especially Cuban. And we met some great, great curators and artists, and some of them all lived in the same building.
Hmm.
Gutenberg itself as a town is like something like 4 blocks wide and 12 blocks long.
Mm-hmm.
But it has these three old towers that, in the galaxy, that have been built in the, I don't know, 60s or something around there. And there's like 7,000 people in there. So Gutenberg is considered one of the most densest towns in America, but only because of these buildings. And they function like a city in and of themselves. Like there's a grocery store and a bowling alley mm-hmm, there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty fantastic to learn and discover. And there's just such a lack of arts, the arts in general in Northern New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
By creating an artist in residence and then expanding it into like an art center, which is now where it's sort of growing, because it's growing, you know, it's educational classes for adults and children and doing a summer camp. And there's been 2 years of this really big, the J.J. Braddock Park Arts Festival, where it's like tons of free demos all day long. And there's an artist market. And then they do like steamroller printmaking, and they commission sculpture now in the park. And they've really sort of activated the park in a way that it hasn't been used in the past. And there's a lake house that will now have art classes in the future. So the impact was really important to the town, because the schools, you know, their arts and music budgets are being cut, and there's nothing. And the people in the neighborhood would come to, like, our openings were always public, and there was tons of kids. It was very welcoming in regards to this, very welcoming to, like, the local neighborhood. And people would come across the street, and they would be like, this is what we need, this is what we don't have, and really, really feel comfortable to communicate that to us.
And the artists who are been doing residencies there, are they from the area, or are they from outside, or both?
A bit all over. So the residency structure is that there's three residents for 3 months, and then there's a stipend that covers, you know, materials, transportation, and what have you, depending on what finances are available in that budgetary year. Generally, it ranges from like $400 to like possibly $1,000. There's not a lot of arts grants money in New Jersey or even family foundations compared to the New York area.
Right.
And that was tricky as well. But the residents also got, we brought in visiting critics. They got, you know, a solo group show, the gallery could be used as a project room. There's in the warmer months, there's a huge backyard for like making sculpture and testing, experimenting, you know, larger things, larger ideas. One of the things that I did when I was there was to start a Women in Print panel. And we did 2 years of that. And so, but having conversations with artists is really, you know, we really tried to see what our public wanted. So instead of having separate artist talks, Gutenberg Arts would ask the artists in residence to give an artist talk during their opening, which is when most people came. Mm-hmm. And then it was really nice. People would like kids, they would ask real solid questions. We had such an impact, and it's just only growing. So a lot of what I was there for is, you know, to get a lot of these things, internal operations and structures and grant writing and board documents, you know, those sort of more boring things,
yeah.
about running a nonprofit, like, in place. So, yeah.
Does some of that experience come from you having done a number of residencies, or was it something else that you were doing?
And I think it's a combination of both. I mean, when a few years ago I had decided to go back to school to Parsons for design and urban ecology. And so during that, even though I thought I was going back into urban planning, I actually found myself having like semesters worth of like nonprofit organization and community organizing and a lot of like logistics around how, you know, those things actually work and to sustain them and to make things happen, which is super helpful. But years before, I mean, I sustained my art career by going to artist residencies all over the globe. You know, the real estate in New York is really expensive, and to be able to have a studio and an apartment and not have a full-time job so you can make your work and all that, it's just, it's almost impossible
right.
for most people. So at a certain point when one of my relationships had broken up, someone had mentioned to me, like, why don't you go do an artist residency? And I was like, what's that? And I just started applying everywhere to everything. I mean, I didn't have to be anywhere at any time. At the time, I had no obligations except for to make art. So, well, that and a student loan, of course, but, you know.
This was pretty early on then that you were applying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like,
so you didn't have a job that you had to be at?
I got fired from my job.
That's where you had the freedom.
I guess.
So that's where you had the freedom, is what I was saying.
Yes, that's when I discovered freedom. And I wanted to figure out a way also how to travel the world because I didn't have any money for anything.
Right.
I don't, you know, I come from a lower middle class family, and that just was. I had done a little traveling. I didn't even get on an airplane until I almost graduated college. You know, when people travel before that. And I found it was amazing. Like when I started traveling for artist residencies, like to be able to see how other art communities functioned and it functioned like within their governments, like just having the conversations with like what artists were given, like grants, little cities and towns in different countries actually had like a burst for purchasing local artists' art. Like the city would collect their own artists' art.
Mm.
And I thought that was fantastic, you know, just that being an artist was a career, a viable career path, and that the government structures were there to make that happen, just like the postman or, you know, the teacher.
And, are you talking about Germany or what kind of countries are you talking about when you say that?
Yeah, like Denmark, a lot of the Nordic countries, Denmark and Finland and Sweden, and the Netherlands, Switzerland, you know, those were the most obvious ones. They also gave, like when they would host you, they would give a house, a studio, or a big like live workspace, and then a stipend on top of that. And some even would give like a living stipend and a travel stipend or a material stipend.
Wow, that was what I was wondering whether any of them got you there. And it sounds like so the best ones, in other words, they would get you there and they would give you money to live on as well as a place to work in while you were there.
Oh yeah. There was one that I ended up turning down because my second child, my son, was born, and it would have been like 6 months in Finland where there was a house, a studio, a bicycle, a daily stipend, a school for my daughter, like an English finished school. And it was just like, and like travel. You know, family wise, Max was really too young.
Right.
So it was really unfortunate to have to turn, and I couldn't put it off a year. Like they wouldn't let me defer, which was a little heartbreaking, but I understand that.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of residencies.
Right.
Can't really have that capacity.
How many residencies would you say you've done over the years total, more or less?
Oh, like at least a dozen.
Okay. No, so not like a gigantic amount, but a hefty amount.
And
yeah. I mean, I was thinking like in the 20s or something based on all the ones that you're talking about.
Oh my God. I mean, like, I don't know that I've been alive enough to have done that many. I mean, it depends. Like I was looking for the ones that were longer term.
Oh, okay.
Because if I didn't, if I had an apartment, I would sublet it out. So I would go like 3 to 9 months.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's different. I was thinking And I'm sure most people listening were probably thinking more along the, you know, 3 to maybe 5 weeks at the outset kind of range, which is the more the summer residency type of situation. But you're talking about real hardcore residency. Do you think, by the way, that when you do a residency, having done so many yourself, that there's kind of a point where you really get on a roll? In other words, take your typical sort of summer, you know, 3 to 4 week type of residency and compare it to the ones that you've done, you know, that are several months. Is there a certain point where you, in retrospect, notice that like, oh, now I'm sort of really kind of getting in the swing of things, whereas if you're just doing maybe the 3 to 4 weeks, you might be getting that and then it ends?
I think the short-term ones are strange. And honestly, it really depends on your process. Like, or if you have a specific project. Like, if you don't have the space wherever you are and you need a certain kind of space to make a project to, like, work out an idea, and you just go and you're super focused and that's all it is, that's cool. But I find for myself, and I can't really speak for other people, like, there's lifestyles where they don't get more than a couple weeks at a time to go away.
Right.
Where that kind of like settling in, I feel that it takes a good 3-4 weeks to settle into a place. And then you get going, and then you just like at the end, you're just like crazy working because you're like, oh my God, I'm going to leave. And I got to get all the stuff done before. But it's like, yeah. I did recently do a week in Wasaic, and I brought my kids. It was like one of the first family artist residencies. So they gave us a house. They gave me a studio. They have this thing called the Art Nest, which is like a big studio for kids. So like they have their own studio. And wow. I was like, what am I going to do in a week? How do I deal with making something in a week? And so I prepared and planned way more than I've ever in my own process. And I gave myself room to fail and be like, it doesn't matter if nothing works out. I'm just going to bring all this stuff and try it and see what works.
Right, right.
And then, yeah.
So when you, over the years applying to these things, do you think that having a more specific or a really specific project or plan that you have for the time you're there is one of the big elements of getting into these things? I mean, I guess I grant that each residency application scenario is different, but I mean, maybe that what I would suggest it and any other things that come to mind for you, what are some of the things that are patterns that you've noticed?
Oh, that's interesting, because when I was at Gutenberg, you know, everyone had to apply with a project. And the jury would review it and the board would review it for its viability. But in the end, if they came and they were like, you know what, this isn't really working out for me, or I'm at a different place because it's like 2 months later or whatever. And they're like, I really want to do this. And it's fine because they're so committed at that point, you know, that you're there to support them. And over the years I've proposed specific things and they're like, you don't have to do that. I think what they want you to do is something. Sometimes it's hard because it depends on someone's practice, whether they make a lot of objects or not. And sometimes it's hard for organizations to be objective on how they're like, oh, look at all the stuff they made. They must have worked a lot. And that's not necessarily true. And sometimes you just need the space to sit around and think.
Right.
And that's a really hard one. But I found that I had a lot of good experience where my practice, where I'm interested in places.
That's two practices, Caitlin. Sorry.
What?
I'm sorry, Caitlin. I said that's two practices. You held it off for a while, but now you've reached your limit, your quota. So go ahead. I'm sorry. Keep going.
Wait, I can't have more? What are you talking about?
No, you can say process. That's fine. You were using process beautifully, and then you hit the P word, and I was like, oh, shit. Okay, go ahead.
Well, the way that I work, generally speaking, has to do with the site itself.
Mm-hmm.
So when I apply with a project or an idea based around that place or building. I don't usually apply to residencies that don't have a context for
right,
me.
Right. And do you think they generally prefer that over people who are making objects for a show or, you know, something that has nothing to do with where they're making it?
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean,
it's a case by case
thing. Yeah, I think it's case by case, but it also it has to do with their jury process, because sometimes their jury process is done by their board or their jury process is done by independent jurors.
Right.
Which could be a variety of curators from all over the place. Or if they're really if they're very interested in about having artists make work about that space, they're pretty forward about it. In their application process,
right?
They're like, they will say the most successful projects are X, Y, Z, and you're like, oh, I get it. That's what they were looking for, or that's what they're inclined to do. But usually, they're generally open. I think a lot of artist residencies are some are geared towards like super emerging artists, and some are geared to like really established artists, or at least artists that have done residencies before, because it's tricky running a residency. You have to negotiate all these people's personalities,
right,
and their lifestyles, and like there's like on the back end of the organizational aspect of it, there's like liabilities, like, you know, harassment or bed bugs. Or, like, there's all kinds of crazy things, you know, like accidentally microwaving something metal and the microwave blows up at somebody. You know, like,
I'm glad you mentioned, you know, the expectations or the needs of the residencies, because one of the things that I wanted to bring up is the sort of has to do with some of my experience with, several years ago, which was the sort of classic East Coast residencies like McDowell and Yaddo, you know, and places like that.
Oh, yeah.
And you can probably speak well to what their deal is. But I think you're mentioning that, you know, they want people of experience with residencies. That seems to be that those places are about reputations. And they're also, though, about persistence too, because some of these places you apply several times apparently and then you finally get in is what I've heard.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I've heard that for certain grants as well.
Mm-hmm.
And like I've heard all kinds of like little tricks like, oh, you need to have someone who got it before be like all of your recommendations, like, all
right.
of, you know, like, or, you know, like little things like that.
That's a lot of hoops to jump through, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, and it's hard to be objective too. I mean, depending on like even how blind the jury is,
mm-hmm.
like, do they do it internally or do they have like, or do they say, oh, this is done by outside expertise? The ones in Europe are very different. They have a different like legalities attached to them because they also say these decisions are not contestable.
Yeah.
And when we were at Gutenberg, we did have some, like, since it was a global application, we got like so many applications from internationals, and that were all amazing, but a lot of them logistically actually couldn't come because of visas, because of time frames, because of like all kinds of things. But on the other hand, when you have someone that's local or somebody that's really experienced, there's a certain reliability there that you know they will come and use the facilities.
Right.
I think that residency's biggest fears are taking the chance on someone and not having them show up when hundreds of other artists are in desperate need of space and time to make work, and they could have served those people.
Right. I have to wonder, it sounds all very practical and business-like and whatnot. But I, you know, all this time, I have to wonder if you have any good stories from all these years and all these different residencies. I mean, if not any particular anecdotes come to mind, you know, maybe you can talk about the dynamics of being with the other artists, or, you know, or the people who run the things and so on and so forth. What comes to mind?
I don't have any really great stories.
Yeah, see, like, that's what I thought.
Oh my God, that's so embarrassing.
You're busted.
It does. It sounds... I'm totally like... Oh my goodness. I do think that sometimes there's a language barrier. Like when you go to different countries and like you're both speaking English, but you understand one word one way and they mean it another way.
Mm.
And that's the disconnect that like over what's being provided, like the logistics of it. Also expectations, like sometimes artists have a lot of expectations of like, oh, I thought that you were going to publicize my open studio for me to like the local museums, or I thought you were going to make these connections, like provide all these other services that that really do support an artist's practice, that they don't. And so I've come across some grumpy artists.
Well, you're talking about it from the Gutenberg side, as it were. What about from your side as the artist? I mean, were you in that place too, where you felt like the residency should have done? That was you?
No, that was me. No, that was me being at other residencies and watching other artists being grumpy about not getting.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's, I got it. But so these were your fellow residents, but you weren't feeling like that ever.
No, I mean, maybe I should expect more, but I feel like I've been in some pretty tricky arrangements and had expectations of like gallerists that never worked out or quite early on. So since I had those really bad experiences, which I think most every artist has at least one really bad experience with a gallerist.
Yeah.
I tried to be really careful after that. So I would get my work back. I would get paid for works being sold, or having the tough conversations about who's covering what's going on and what is expected of me during this time. So there's not any miscommunication. The last thing I want is to get to a residency and not be able to do the work I want to do.
Yeah.
It totally defeats the purpose. So I've been pretty vocal and pretty practical about everything and everyone I deal with. And I have a fairly low tolerance for the unspoken. And any time in the last decades that I've had interns or studio assistants or anybody helping me with my work and they want to have a dialogue around, you know, how do you get a gallery or, you know, whatever kind of art world questions, like contracts or whatever, I always am very upfront about like have that conversation, like who's paying for the shipping,
right,
who's insuring that,
right,
who's doing this. And so I think it also translates into the artist residency realm as well. And when I was at Gutenberg, I would try to do as much as I could for the artists. Like one of the things I always said, like if there's anybody you want to be in touch with, I will absolutely reach out to them on your behalf, but I will make no promises.
So did you apply the weaknesses of the residencies that you went to the way that you handled Gutenberg then, to some extent?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think I wanted to make it what I never got, or what I thought that a residency could really do for artists. And that was all the other little extras that made residencies great.
Right. But you, meanwhile, it seems like you were in these residencies and didn't expect these kinds of special treatment things where they would hook you up with the press or the local museums, and some of your fellow artists did. That seems, frankly, pretty whiny to me. I mean, correct me or tell me if I'm wrong, but that seems really whiny bitch kind of behavior. doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like, unless they pitched themselves as a residency that they would, you know, be doing something along those lines and then not do it.
Yeah.
Which would be, but I always thought, like, when I, you know, we went for 3 months to Steinenheim, to this residency. So it's right out, it's a medieval town right outside of Zurich. So mm-hmm. we're in like the oldest medieval town and living in a turret. And
wow. What was that like, living in a turret?
It was awesome. I like actually like we totally fell in love with this town. Also, they made the best donuts ever. They like we thought we were going to move there and stay. I mean, there was a year where my husband took a sabbatical from his job, and like we traveled. Our daughter was one, and we traveled to all these artist residencies. And this was the first one, and they gave like this huge tour. So it's like turret. There's like 4 floors. The studio was enormous on the first floor, and they were so amazing. It was run by a foundation associated with the city. This brother and sister who like gave all this money to restore. Like there was a castle right behind the medieval wall, and there was this perfect painted town. There was the oldest convent, like, I think, in, you know, Western Europe there from, like, 1007 it was amazing. Mm-hmm. But then, like, the mayor would just stop in. He'd just, like, knock on the door and be like, hey, how are you doing? And I'm like, huh, hi. So
wow.
That was, yeah, I mean, that's sort of, like, where the city and the towns are really involved in what's like going. I mean, granted, it was a really, really small town.
Right.
But they cared. They cared about the arts and culture and
right.
and the impact of bringing, you know, international artists. So.
And it wasn't about, in that case, your sort of getting, you know, in with the Swiss museum system or anything like that. It was more like getting an opportunity to make work and interact with that specific town, right? Is that a fair analysis of the situation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but my husband's Swiss, so like if I wanted to get in with the Swiss museum system, like I think I'd probably have to have a more established career and move to Switzerland.
Right.
And I have to say, though, the Kunsthalls, the Kunstvereins in Switzerland, the way they take care of art, an artist there is phenomenal. Mm. One of the best parts of being there was that we could travel around easily. It's a really small country, so you could get from Zurich to Geneva in like 3 hours.
Right.
But there was a ton of great museums, and being there for 3 months really allowed us to go and see those and meet people, meet other curators. I did meet quite a few people, and they were really open to being like, oh, you're doing this residency, you know, come down and visit. We're having an opening, or we're having this lecture. Do you want to come? And that's, I found to be true. Like also in Salzburg, and when I was in Austria, like I flew into Munich and then took a shuttle to Salzburg. Mm-hmm. But when I was in Munich, people really opened, like, oh, come drop by.
Mm-hmm.
In Salzburg, like someone had given me the phone number for the photo curator at the Museum of Modern Art in Salzburg, like the phone number to call up. They're like, just call. And I call, and they're like, I'll come tomorrow if you're not doing anything. I was like, I'm not busy.
Right.
So, but that was fantastic. And I found that artist residencies were a great door to broadening my network or scope, or just really having the kind of conversations and dialogues with other people that I so had wanted and hadn't been able to have.
Right. Did you meet your husband in the States or in Europe, by the way?
Oh, in New York.
Okay. But then you got to go back to his country, as it were.
For like a sabbatical.
Right.
He's an architect, so his career is kind of here. Although I kept trying to get him to move back to Europe, it just hasn't happened.
Did you want to move back? Did you want to move to Europe?
I was living there when we met. I had just come back. I was in Berlin for quite some, on and off for quite some time, and it was sort of like a life decision. He wasn't going to move to Berlin, so
right.
I was like, what am I going to do in New York? I had been away for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really started re-examining New York and the artist residencies in New York. And I ended up doing a few, but they only give you studio space.
Right.
So that's the tricky part about artist residencies, like in New York City especially, they'll give you a free studio. If it's another country sponsoring it, maybe they give you an apartment as well. But then, like, being here is wicked expensive. And I've noticed a lot of the artist residencies in New York have either disappeared or completely changed just to survive.
Yeah, right. And how long has it been since you had a residency last?
Well, I just went to Wassaic in April.
That's not long. Where's that?
Upstate New York.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's called, the Wassaic Project. So it's a couple hours up the Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
And it's founded by a bunch of artists and it's run by a bunch of artists and they're wonderful. They're amazing. There's an amazing community up there. They run a big arts festival and it's the kind of residency that it's very inclusive. They do exhibitions. It's this crazy old mill on this like really tiny train stop that's up there that they've converted into studios and exhibition space. And they have living, they do like summer and winter residencies for different time periods. So you kind of find almost like what works for you in a way. I will be going to the iPark Foundation the first 2 weeks in August, which is in East Haddam, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for a family residency, so it's going to be us and three other families.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first time they're doing that. And then this fall, I'll be at Gallery of Pharaoh in Newark.
Wow, so you're doing a lot around the area then. And are all of these local ones ones where you stay at the place as well as work there?
Wassaic was. iPark is as well. Gallery of Pharaoh is a studio-based residency, but they got a big grant from the Sustainable Art Foundation, which is a new foundation based in California, and they only fund artists and writers that are parents.
Wow.
So they give individual grants, and they give residencies grants to run programs for artists that are parents. So they give a grant, and I think they have all kinds of different policies. Like I know at, like the Vermont Studio Center also received a grant, but they give you the grant money so you can pay a caretaker to stay home and the artist goes in residence. But someplace like iPark, because iPark received also a grant from the Sustainable Arts Foundation, they are housing and like it's a house, a studio. They pay for summer camp for the kids. And then they also have a chef come in and make like four dinners a night or week, which also helps keep artists in their studios. And then with Gallery of Pharaoh, it's the studio and then a stipend.
Mm-hmm.
So I will live where I am. And then
I think the reason that I was asking you about the recent residency that you did is because you did mention, being back in New York, as it were, after Europe, even though it's probably been a while now. But have you had a place to work since you've been back in the city at all?
Yeah. I mean, when I came back to New York, I started, I guess settling down, so to speak. And then I started to apply to the residencies here. I was very lucky to get a very large Pollock Krasner many years ago. And so when I was pregnant with my first child, that really sustained my practice. It paid for the studio and a babysitter and the materials to make work for an exhibition. The year after that, we left. And then when we came back, I did the Abrams Arts Center residency. And I also did like the Triangle Arts residency for 9 months. So I tried to do a lot of them that are based here in New York. They don't come with all like the accoutrements necessarily of like the visiting critics or the connections to people stopping by, because there's not the infrastructure in these organizations. At Abrams Art Center, they did have that, but this is many, many years ago. The Triangle Arts did not do that, but I think they do that now. They didn't at the time that I was there. They did have a lot of open studios. So someplace like EFA has open studios. And now I have a studio at Spaceworks in the Gowanus.
Which is?
Spaceworks is a new arts nonprofit, and they provide subsidized, stable performance space and studios for artists in New York.
Wow.
So it was a lottery. I won the lottery. I finally won the lottery.
So it was a random lottery?
Basically, yeah. You had to apply. They have a large studio build out in the Gowanus, and then they have some in Williamsburg, and I believe there's some somewhere else for the visual arts studios. And you had to apply and be vetted as like a practicing artist. And then basically they did it by lottery, and they had, you know, you could choose your studio depending on where you were picked in the lottery and what was available to you. And so it happened at like a really perfect time. I wanted to commit to being in New York. I wanted to commit to being to my practice, because I've often been, you know, diverged from it and done, you know, other things. And having stable studio space near my house and near where my kids go to school and near my job was really important. And it was perfect. And it's been rough, you know, like it's not the perfect build out. We had a whole bunch of leaks in the ceiling, and they repaired that, and they've been really responsive to the artists and their needs. So it's been actually a really great experience.
Do you feel like having this, you know, lottery winning studio and then going, in addition, going off to all these residencies is like gobbling up a lot of real estate in a way?
What do you mean by gobbling up?
Well, in other words, you've got people who you have other artists who not only don't have subsidized studio space, but they're not doing residencies. So they're like overpaying for tiny little spaces somewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that sucks.
Yeah.
I think honestly, like it's not like my rent is cheap. And I know the Elizabeth Foundation as well. Those studios are not cheap. And like the residency programs, like they're paying a pretty penny. It's hard. Over in Gutenberg, you know, like it's still $1 a square foot, but the access to people and networks like is getting easier. People are more open-minded about it. And there's all kinds of different residencies housed in universities where you have access to space. But I think that the whole lack of space is heartbreaking. And I have a lot of internal conflict about my situation. I mean, I've been where I'm living on $2 a day in Berlin, like, you know, crashing on my super good friend's couch for months on end.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like I've done that, and going to different artist residencies across the globe has really provided some stability to at least continuing making. But I've done things like, you know, I've worked in an office, and I appreciate those experiences too, because it helps me negotiate like contracts and be confident to say no to situations and exhibitions that are not going to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I've also noticed in the Gowanus the amount of real estate that's being gobbled up there for housing is unbelievable. I mean, there's a lot of people being kicked out of great buildings where in a lot of other cities across the world, it would just be secured as, you know, this is a creative arts building. And, you know, we're going to make space for that and not, you know, drool over it for condos.
Right.
It's hard to watch that. And we often think, okay, if we leave, where do we go? Why would we go to wherever we would go? Is it about space? Is it about getting more space? Do we need that much space to live and to work? How is being in an urban center important? Is it the people? I didn't have a studio for years on end, and I still had a practice. I would just do big site-specific installations, and that was fine for quite some time. I know it's not easy for a lot of people because they have to work like a full-time job, and they decided to have a family, and they don't have a lot of support. And you always feel like you're like the grind. But then if you leave, what are you leaving?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, you know, the people, I hate saying the word inspiring, but sometimes it feels like that.
Inspiring people or inspiring what?
Just being in an urban center where there's ideas and life is happening. And it can be quite the drudgery as well that can be inspiring to make amazing things come out of that.
Mm-hmm. So you're implying that the thought of potentially leaving, because we had talked about the environmental, the lack of air quality and whatnot earlier conversation, that is really kind of off the table for now, leaving because of the things you just talked about.
No, I mean, like, leaving is always on the table for me, only because I'm so interested in the rest of the world. Like, I only have one bucket list, and it's to see as many places as I possibly can with my own eyes before I'm done with this world. So that's probably why my work is about what it is, and probably why I've traveled so much and wanted to see as much as I possibly can. I would love to definitely have a break because the air quality is so bad and my son has really bad food allergies and asthma and a lot of health problems. I struggle with that on a daily basis. Sometimes I just make myself not think about it. And sometimes I remember that there's a lot of people that are a lot of worse off and don't have access to the kind of healthcare that we have.
So what's first on the list of a place to go, since you think about it a lot?
I think about where's the cleanest air in the world. That sounds crazy.
What's the answer?
I don't know. I haven't Googled it yet. I think I'm too afraid to, because I'll be like, okay, let's move there. We're done.
Right. And why are you afraid of that?
I think there's a lot of other things to contend with that have to do with the rest of life. It's not just my choice, you know.
What is your husband's desire? Just to stay?
I don't know. You should ask him. No, he has a different perspective because he's actually not American. He was born in Switzerland and raised on the French-Swiss border. So he knows what it's like to live in Europe for, you know, the majority of his life. I think that he finds America fascinating, especially New York. And for architects, it's amazing. The speed at which things are built, the speed at which they change. And this is a lot of the dialogue between us, like, especially for my practice as well, like, because I'm really interested in the urban. I think that at a certain point, maybe our family becomes more of a forefronted concern. What I'm worried about is that I'm not contending with the idea of like the goldfish scenario. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, what's the goldfish scenario?
So it's like you had a goldfish and like you bring it home, you went in a fair and you bring it home and it's this tiny little goldfish in this bag. And then you get like, you know, the classic round bowl and it right. gets a little bigger. And then you're like, oh, wait, I could get a bigger tank and more goldfish. And then they get bigger and then they just grow to the size of the tank.
Mm.
And it sort of refers back to when you said gobbling up space and real estate. So,
yeah, I'm very cognizant. I mean, artists are obviously the least culprits, at least in the art world, when it comes to that kind of thing. But if you've got a nice studio and you're doing a bunch of residencies, you know, when you're in New York, you know, it's just notable, I'd say. I mean, I know I'm not trying to make you out to be the bad guy, but it pricked up my ears a little bit. That's all.
That's a good question. I mean, no, we should talk about that, because I do. There's a point where I was like, I feel a little bit too privileged right now.
Always a tough challenge to have.
Yeah, but and then what do you do about it, though?
Yeah.
I haven't contended with it as much as I really should.
Mm.
And I know we moved to this neighborhood to be in the public school zone. So we didn't have to pay for school, which we're very adamant to participate in the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
But we moved to a very expensive neighborhood because we needed to be in the public school zone that had the only French English dual language program that we could have access to for our kids, because Laurent speaks French. Like, I am not fluent in French, so I can't teach them.
Right.
And they can't speak to like half of their family.
Right.
So that decision.
That's a good reason.
At the time. Yeah.
Yeah. You just explained, going back to the beginning of our conversation, why you are where you are, you know, as much as you yeah. are at peace with, the place, you know, in an auditory sense, if not an air sense, environmental sense. Yeah, so you're in Carroll. So you are in that sense in Carroll Gardens, because Carroll Gardens is the type of neighborhood that would have a French English school, right?
It has become that because years ago, so the public school that was here was not known to be the greatest public school, and the principal made a decision. This is quite some time ago, like what, a decade ago, to, with the help of some parents that were French and said, had proposed it, like, why don't we bring a dual language program that's French? And they approached the consulate and worked through it, and the principal was open to it. And so it established a track record, and then it just started attracting tons of international families. And then all of a sudden, it's a very desirable school. And this is what happens. You all of a sudden have a really desirable school, people, because families and people are participating, among other reasons. And then the school districts, the elementary school districts, can be really small. And this is a minute one.
Mm-hmm.
And so the real estate prices skyrocketed. And in a way, it really helps the public school because, you know, property taxes go into public schools. But it also made it incredibly unaffordable. And then a lot of the, you know, the original inhabitants of the neighborhood, they feel pressured to sell. And then all these, like, you know, old families or very, like, culturally important neighborhoods just get torn apart. This one's just a little tricky because, like, where we live, there's a cement, you know, the concrete cement factory the Gowanus Canal, which is a Superfund site, and an oil depot, and the BQE mm-hmm. are right here. So as pretty as it might look-ish, because there's, you know, some nice-looking brownstones, if someone were to come and do some hardcore, like, year-long air quality testing, I would probably be hysterically crying for days on end and should leave. I mean, there are several, like, in this neighborhood, there are so many kids with asthma problems. And I had to go, because my son is entering the public kindergarten next fall, I had to go talk to the nurse about what are all the, you know, the paperwork I have to fill out to have an EpiPen and an inhaler in school. And I asked her, I was like, how many kids in this school, you know, have asthma, have a para with them because of food allergies or all the other things? And she was like, there's 1,000 kids in the school right now, which is at its limit. And something like, what, 40 of the kids have EpiPens and inhalers, are, you know, of varying degrees. And that, to me, that seems like a good chunk for a really small area. So
I think, I'm sorry, let me interject, because I think what you're pointing out inadvertently is how there's this confluence of a sort of swiftly gentrifying neighborhood, as many neighborhoods in New York are, and then you have at the same time this pretty substantial environmental problem. You know, it's not, despite the incredible inflation of value, you know, and rent costs, you still have these realities alongside.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just pure down near the Gowanus and the BQE. It's like Newtown Creek, you know, and it's such, at this point, because there is such a lack of affordable housing, they're just building everywhere.
Yeah.
Like there, and it's really, I think, for a city to manage its density and to help everyone, like, it's crazy. Like, it's so many moving parts, and not just people's desires and needs on a health basis, but also the legal aspects of it, the actual land aspects of it, like how much, you know, is available. When I went back to school to Parsons to get a Master of Science in Design and Urban Ecology, I ended up doing my master's thesis on creating a community air trust, because one of the things that I've always been concerned about is the air quality and, you know, my son's asthma and the trauma that we've been through and the emergency rooms and the just all the medication and some really, really traumatic experiences, which is nothing compared to some people, really, so many people. And doing this thesis on trying to figure out how can we protect our air while also creating affordable housing, like air rights are just considered unbuilt land. Its value is changing fast as much as real estate is changing. But the value of air quality in terms of like preserving that and protecting that is hard, because there's air that stands still and then air that moves. Mm-hmm. But there's no like legal operation that protects it in the way that, like, okay, well, the EPA can come in to the Gowanus and declare it a Superfund site and work to clean it up. You know, there's no process like that for air.
Right.
So this, you know, creating the idea of a community air trust is taking a neighborhood like Carroll Gardens that has a building cap on it, and part of it has a landmark status, and having those homeowners or building owners pool their air rights together to have some sort of asset that they can negotiate clean air with. It was something that I was trying to focus on to see if it was even like a possibility or a reality to happen. And I found in the course of doing that, and when I was done, that the legal structure is just not there and is such an intense process, but it all starts with being able to prove that the air is bad, and there's no way to get any major, like the EPA or anybody, to come and do that.
I see. So let me address the larger story arc here, which is that this all started when we started talking about looking at privilege and then the neighborhood that you're in and so on. But the story arc that I see is that you were having the opportunity to do all these residencies, many of them abroad, you know, including lovely places like Switzerland. And and now, largely due to your, completely due to the combination of your having a family, you know, having your kids be in school, and your husband who grew up in Europe and is like, okay, I'm happy to be in New York and sort of explore all of its possibilities and advance my architecture and so on, that you are making you are rooted in New York and you are making the best of it, including trying to figure out this sticky air situation. But part of you probably, I would imagine, part of you probably wants to be back, you know, that you probably, part of you is longing for not only just residencies, you know, which are, you probably get a bit of an addiction to, but also just, you know, the simplicity, as it were, of these other places. And so you have to reconcile not having that by saying, you know, well, you have all this inspiration in New York, you know, which is true. I understand that. And that's why so many people are there and want to be there and want to go there. And the people who are, have gotten kicked out or have left because of it's unsustainable, you know, they have to, you know, restart, reinvent, and so on. Does that all sound about right?
Yeah, thanks. I guess we're done. Bye.
Exactly.
there's a few disclaimers I want to interject in there. And one is I've gotten tons of rejections from like all over. So I, you know, with all doing all these residencies, it's like getting one out of like 50 applications. So I
Well, that's really important. Sorry. Let's not pass over that too quickly, because that I think is really something that we slid over quickly, which is, you, I think there was an impression that was coming from the residency part of the conversation that, the sense I got anyway, was that you got into, you know, one or a few of these pretty early, and then it was like, boom, you know, now I can just pretty much apply to whatever I want. So what in fact is actually happening, as you just said, is you're actually talking about a 1 in 50 ratio. Is that really true? That low?
I apply for even more now that they're all digital. Like, I remember the days where you had to have slides made and you had to like get the right labels and like the arrows. Like, I remember being so broke at one point asking for my birthday from my parents. So this is, you know, like before relationships or any kind of
right.
desire to have stability in my life.
Right.
For a slide carousel. So, so I could see, you know, what it was to apply to these. But no, I don't know how it happened, because my memory sucks apparently. But I think that along the way, someone, maybe it was a professor, that just said, keep applying, you know, don't take rejection personally.
Right.
You are up against, you know, so many people, and the jurors are different all the time. And there's no way to cultivate that at all. There, you have no control over that. So just keep doing it. Like, why not? You can't win something if you're not in it. So I spend tons of time after, you know, I put the kids to bed, like up till midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, applying for things.
Wow.
Grants, residencies.
See,
yeah,
that's a really specific picture, and I'm glad we have that image. Is it, so here's, I think, one of the big questions that comes from that is, does it get any easier doing it? I mean, you get better at it, I know, but is it a pain in the ass every time you do it, I think is another way to put it?
It depends on how sloppy I am. With the advent of, like, I mean, even when images got, when you could put it on a CD-ROM and, like, send that, that was amazing.
Yeah.
Because then you could just keep a certain amount of, like, and this is where, like, the business part of, like, an artist's career is very unsexy and unappealing, but super practical and helpful.
Yeah.
Is like, I would keep different sets of images in different folders on my desktop, and I would have a couple different like artist statements or project proposals, because I just kept having to write them. I was like, I'm just going to keep this one and
right.
categorize this under whatever. So I got really organized. So when I came across something, I could easily just put it together and send it off. The fact that you can apply online is just like, so efficient, it's ridiculous.
Right.
You know, years ago, when I was doing I did years and years of freelance graphic design. And so, like, having those skills of like Photoshop and altering and the resizing just became something so second nature that I didn't think about it. And I didn't want to have any regrets. I didn't want to be like, I wish I'd gotten that, and thought, I can't not get something if I don't even apply for it.
Right.
So, and I have applied for things tons of times and then gotten them. And there are things that I've applied for that have just happened right off the bat. I did notice, though, once you've done a certain amount of residencies or gotten a certain amount of grants, it's a little bit easier. And then there's a point where you tap down to the things you actually can apply for.
Right.
So, and then you have to be nominated, and that's like a whole nother ball game. And like networking and other things that you have to, that you work at. And that's definitely something that benefits from being in an urban center and
sure.
being in contact with a variety of people to see your work.
Yep. Yeah, right.
But yeah, the rejections were there for sure. And I love the Chris Burden piece where he like had a whole wall full of like his rejections for over years and years of rejections, and he kept them all and he just put them all on. That was a beautiful piece.
When was that piece from? Do you remember the name of it?
Oh my God. It's probably called something like Failure.
Right. Here's a practical question that before I forget about these applications, whether they're the residencies that we've been talking about or grants. Do you have to follow to a T? In other words, if it stipulates, you know, you need to be showing regularly, that kind of thing, which can be a little fuzzy, you know, do you just say, fuck it, go for it anyway? Or is it more like you say, it's not for me?
Something like that could be relative, because it depends on how they're defining regularly.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're in like one group show every 5 years, that's not so regularly, I think, in terms of what they mean if they are making a point of stating it. But I do think that you should just apply to everything. But I also do think that one should research what they apply for,
right,
to make sure it's good for them. If they happen to know somebody that's applied for something, like if there's an age limit, don't apply if you don't meet the age limit. Or like if you haven't like graduated yet, like if you won't graduate by the start, like if you actually can't fulfill the basic like be there, or if you're away too much during the residency, like those are things that residencies don't like, because it doesn't. There are so many other artists that they can serve that can meet those basic requirements.
Right. Got it. Okay. Was there another disclaimer that you wanted to throw in based on my cursory story arc of your life?
Is that what it was? Oh, my God. I don't know. Let's see. There probably were, but I've gotten a little sidetracked, I think.
You made a really good point by pointing out that, you know, that this residency thing wasn't just some magic carpet ride that, you know, which is kind of maybe what I was painting a little bit, you know, that it's a lot of grit, you know, and a lot of rejection as well. But maybe there was something else you know, why you are where you are, and, you know, that it's mainly because of your family and your husband, and I don't know, anything, anywhere in that area that I was describing that you had another disclaimer about. It sounds like I got it otherwise.
Well, I didn't, it's funny because we were talking and I wasn't realizing that it was seeming so rosy. And then when you summed it up, it seemed also nicely packaged. But there's been tons of, like, you know, heartache and compromise and just downright, like, failure that has happened over the years where I just didn't know, like going back to school, making the decision to have kids, to commit to a relationship, like being an artist, being a woman artist in New York and being in a relationship and then being a mom, like that's a whole nother like conversation.
Yeah.
Where like the scope of your career, and it still like has a lot of old school, like, you know, frowning. And I'm not the kind of person that's like, oh, I've been so underserved, blah, 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 whatever. Whatever. I also know that I haven't necessarily worked as hard at my work as I should at some points in time because I made the choice to commit my life in other areas. And then some people will have a response to that. But that's
I think
one thing.
Most people make that pact. Just about everybody makes that pact. I mean, the people who are sleeping in their studio, you know, in their studio or in the, if they're lucky enough, you know, in the extra office in their studio and waking up and working again, you know, those people are a little crazy. So everybody otherwise makes a pact that they're going to have other aspects of their life, and that's healthy. So you don't have to rationalize that.
You think? It's funny because I kind of have an adverse reaction to that statement. Maybe because I still have a little bit of that romantic notion of an artist, like, I slept in my studio. Like, wait. But, I mean,
to me, that smacks of desperation, actually. Unless you've got, like, a literal deadline that, you know, you have to finish this work that you has already been committed for the show.
True. Fair enough. Yeah. I think it's a really tricky question about your life decisions being different than your job decisions, like your job as being an artist. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I learned doing these residencies that I never would have seen if I hadn't, like I didn't have an opportunity to travel. There was no way to travel unless I did these residencies because I couldn't afford to. Even doing, like I worked, you know, full-time jobs in graphic design. Like I spent years at Oppenheimer Funds in their graphic design department, like wearing business clothes.
Wow.
You know, like, totally. You know, I lived in Queens. I lived in Queens. I traveled an hour on the train down to the World Trade Center every day for years. And taking my vacations, doing residencies, and then one day being like, okay, I'm going to commit to doing freelance so I can actually maybe think about having a studio that I can go to more often.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was a slow burn on both sides, like doing tons of residencies and doing full-time jobs and making various commitments in different ways. So I feel like the decisions that I've made now and the compromises that I made now, I'm a little bit more okay with because I know the extremes on both ends.
Right.
To a certain extent, there's always going to be somebody like better or worse off on either end. But I am a big believer in trying, you know, even if you're trying something different, if you're home with your kids, there's this new residency that I sort of committed to called an artist residence in motherhood, and it doesn't take place anywhere in particular. It occupies the idea of motherhood, so it's like a residency in an idea.
Mm.
And I love that, like I can't get it out of my head.
So what? What is it that is, connects you then with the residency? If it's just a concept, are they actually giving you money, or what's the connection?
No, it's something. It's something that you commit to yourself on your own.
Self-commitment,
term.
Right? Mm-hmm.
And then the woman, Lenka Clayton, she's in Pittsburgh, and actually she is in. Also, we were both invited by Sharon Loudon to write an essay for her upcoming book, Artists as Cultural Producer, about artists being cultural producers. And I wrote my essay about all these residencies, working at a residency, and then participating in family residencies, which are this whole brand new thing. And so Lenka, she founded this artist residency in motherhood, and so it was about committing to this idea of motherhood, and this, and so she documented the work she made in a different kind of way and posted it mostly on social media, and as a, I guess exhibited it since then. But she's founded this where there's like 170 plus artists that participate in it, and they're all over the world, and there's like social media platforms to think about your work. And so one of the aspects about my son having asthma and food allergies is that I'm really going to go every day to lunch for the first few weeks to the public school lunchroom and be there with him and make sure he knows how to negotiate lunch with like 7 kindergarten classes.
Wow.
And right. And so that was a really big conflict for me, because on my not teaching days this fall, I have a little bit of studio time. And that is like a big thing that takes up the entire studio time. And how am I going to, for a long time, I was like, I don't want to be resentful about this aspect of his health. How do I deal with this? And then I came across this artist residency in motherhood, and I was like, I'm going to be in residence in the PS 58 lunchroom every day.
Right.
and document this. And I don't know what will come of it, but the fact that I'm being in residence in this idea of dealing with this health issue in my life and as part of my life in an artistic way is so overwhelmingly amazing to me. That, like, because of all the residencies I've done that have a place that I go to that someone else has chosen, or, you know, like I applied because maybe I wanted to go to that place because of a certain building or topography or city I wanted to see. But this one has something to do with something completely different that's very abstract. It has a location specifically now, but if he's not at lunch in that school, it could be any school. It could be basically his health concern exists everywhere he is.
Yeah.
So I love the idea of being in residence in an idea. And yeah, so what does that mean? So what do residencies mean if it doesn't have a place?
It's a roving residency. It's a residency on the go. Wherever you are, your residency is.
Exactly. And so that kind of solves the real estate problem, right?
Perfect. I think you just found our bow, Caitlin. Well done. I almost forgot. Don't you have a show that's about to open?
I do. I totally forgot. We've talked about so much. It's a big installation that I did at the Katona Museum of Art as part of a group show called On Site. And it's installations and sculptural work that responds to the site. And I spent a week up in Katona with the museum, and who has a new director, Darcy Alexander, who's amazing. And I worked with all their docents, all their membership and their community, even the teenagers, as people to help me draw this large drawing in their atrium space. So I spent a week there solid with.
Wow. Leading up, when we were, you and I were planning when we were going to do this, and you were thinking that we should definitely not do it the evening of when you're installing because you would probably be completely wiped. Was that true?
Oh my God. Yeah. I didn't get home till like midnight, 1 a.m. every night. It was like 8 a.m. to midnight, 1 a.m. all week long. It was,
oh my God.
It was.
Yeah. That sounds exhausting.
Yeah, it was, but it was amazing. I mean, all the conversations with all the crew, there was like 12 people a day all day long. And there was so many amazing stories. The teenagers were fantastic and hilarious. And I really felt like there was a lot of challenges with the space and working site specific, which kind of grew out of the fact that I didn't have a studio for so long. It really developed in a way that the community is involved, and I think of it as a community drawing.
Right. Well, just one other question. When you're working that hard and long, it's usually because there's a minimum labor intensity involved. How much did having the extra hands impact that? In other words, if you had to do it all by yourself, do you think it would have taken you another full day or something? Or do you have any idea?
Or like another full month.
Uh-huh. So is that impactful, in other words?
Absolutely. I can't make them without other people. And it's developed over the years an important aspect of it. They don't happen without other people. And the mark making and the drawing on the walls that the community has becomes an important part of the history of the piece.
Right.
And then it gets painted over and then it becomes part of the building.
Right. Well, we will have images on theconversationpod.com. So
that's
people can
awesome.
Go check
Thank
it out.
You.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks. Oh my God. Thank you. This is amazing. I love talking to you. This conversation has really, challenged me in so many ways.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, maybe we'll have a part two. We'll see.
Oh my God.
And she cringes at that prospect. And we're out. Excellent. Thank you. Wow. Thank you so much again to Caitlin. She was lovely, wasn't she? And if you didn't get that, it's Katona, KATONAH. Museum of Art, which is in Westchester County. That's where the show is opening as this comes out. If you want to support this show, it would be very much appreciated if you could go to iTunes, whether or not you use it, and leave a nice review. It would be really appreciated. The last one we had was on June 20th. So if we can get one before July 20th, that would be awesome. If you just give a 5-star review out of 5 stars, that would be awesome. You don't need to write anything if you don't feel like it. But if you would, that would be awesome. I'll read it on the show upcoming. And, of course, you can follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on both Instagram and Twitter. Would love to see you there, either of those places. And, of course, donations are always very much appreciated by going to theconversationpod.com/support. I want to thank you so much for listening. And if you have any feedback for the show at any time, you are welcome to write in. I have a fantastic response rate for both donations and comments. So happy to hear from you. Let us know what you thought of this episode. And in the meantime, I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.